It's fitting that we talk about Harriet Tubman on this last day of Black History Month. She is a pivotal figure in American and human history, a person who worked to free herself from slavery, then went back and brought more people out through the Underground Railroad in the days before the Civil War. Harriet Tubman is just one of many people profiled in a series of books for young readers, ages 4 to 8, called Ordinary People Change the World. All the books in the series are the creation, the writing, not the pictures, of Brad Meltzer, who is a very prolific writer. His political thriller novels alone now number an even dozen, with The Escape Artist just out. He's also written nonfiction books, won awards for writing for comic books, and written and created TV shows, and hosted a couple of TV shows for history. So a lot on the resume of Brad Meltzer. And thanks for joining us today on The Exchange.
Well, thank you for having me.
I want to start with Lost History, one of the shows you do for history, which we used to be able to call the History Channel, but they got all highfalutin and dropped channel. The 9/11 flag story from Lost History alone is so interesting. Can you tell us what happened there?
Yeah, that was one of the most amazing moments of my life. I went to the History Channel. I still call it channel, sorry. But and I'm on it. You know, I've been on
right.
it, so I can't help it. Old habits. And I said to them, listen, here's what I want to do. There's all these amazing things that are missing in history that we can use a TV show. I'll tell the story of the show, and we'll put it up, a picture of it, tell the story, and we'll get people to bring it back. We'll use a television as the modern-day wanted poster. And I said to them, they said, well, what's missing? I said, well, the flag that the firefighters raised at Ground Zero is missing, and no one knew it was gone. And that's what our first episode was about. And, in fact, that episode, we can talk about it, also actually launched an idea that for my new thriller that's coming out next week also is involved in that story. But to just stay on point for a moment, what happened was is I went on the first episode. I said, here's the flag from 9/11 and the famous photograph that the firefighters raised at Ground Zero. It's missing. Can you find it? What no one knew, and we couldn't tell anyone, is 4 days after that show aired, a man walked into a fire station in Everett, Washington, in Washington State, and said, identified himself as a former Marine, and said, I watched the show Lost History, and this is the 9/11 flag. I have it. I need to return it. And we spent the better part of a year authenticating it, checking the dust for it, checking the halyards, which are the little clips that you know, and the ropes that you raise the flag with. And we had brought in, you know, someone from the FBI who said to us, who was a former FBI guy, said to us that this flag is now more authenticated than most Rembrandts in museums. And I was lucky enough that last year, on the 15th anniversary of 9/11, I got to help unveil that flag. It is now on display in the 9/11 Museum. And people send me photos on my Facebook page and on Twitter showing me, you know, they just sent me one of a Pearl Harbor vet saluting that flag that we helped bring back. And it just, you know, of all the things I've done in my life, whether it's the thrillers, whether it's the kids' books, I don't think anything will ever match being a part of that story and playing that role in it.
That is an amazing story. So let's back up to the beginning. When you graduated from the University of Michigan, what did you plan to do?
You know, the truth was I was in debt. I went to Michigan and I had debt to pay off. And this guy named Eli Siegel said, I'm going to be your mentor, as a businessman in Boston. He said, move all your stuff to Boston, take everything to Boston, and I'm going to be your mentor. I thought, that's a good deal. He said, if you love it, you stay. And if you hate it, you leave with some money in your pocket. You could pay off some of your debt. And again, I thought it was a good deal. I moved all my stuff to Boston and everything to Boston. And the week I got to Boston, he left the job. And I thought, that was my reaction. I thought, I wrecked my life. And so I did what all of us do in situations where we think we wrecked our lives. I said, I'm going to write a novel. And right, what all of us would do in that
right.
situation. I wrote my first novel. It got me quickly 24 rejection letters. To be clear, there were only 20 publishers. I got 24 rejection letters, which meant some people were writing me twice to make sure I got the point. But I said, if they don't like that book, I'm going to write another. And if they don't like that book, I'm going to write another. And the book I wrote after that, the week after, I started a book called The Tenth Justice. And that second book is what became my first published novel, changed my life.
So, Brad, I have this image of you and a laptop and a constant drumming on the keys. I mean, is it really something like that?
No, that's exactly what it's like. I mean, you know, what happens before the drumming on the keys is a lot of research. So just as an example, going back to that 9/11 moment, I was on to that flag is two things happened to me a few years ago. So, you know, just to show you the process, I was on a tour with the USO, and the USO was taking me to we went to the Middle East to entertain our troops, and they take a couple thriller writers every year to go entertain the troops back then. And when I was there, soon after, I found out about Dover Air Force Base. And I didn't really know much about Dover. I knew that that's where our fallen service members are taken when, mm-hmm. when they go down. But I didn't realize that some of the biggest cases go there, too. So the 9/11 Pentagon victims went there. And when the space shuttle went down, it went there. And the USS Cole bombing victims went there. But it also has, interestingly, all of our top secret spies, all of our CIA members, everyone doing secret things for the government, that's where their bodies go to. And it means that Dover Air Force Base is a building full of secrets and a building full of mysteries. And as a mystery writer and thriller writer, I was like, I got to get in there. So I immediately, you know, called them up, said, hey, can I come in? And it was going there and seeing, I never thought they would let me in. No one gets in. I got unprecedented access. They let me in there. And what I saw there and what I saw what they do with some of our top secret service members and people who are spies, I used and built a plot around it for my new thriller, The Escape Artist. So that's when I start pounding the keys after I do the research. And The Escape Artist opens with a woman named Nola Brown. She's a staff sergeant for the Army, and the military says she died in a plane crash. But when our hero of the book, Zig, is putting the body to rest, he sees and finds a hidden note inside Nola's body. And the note says, Nola, you were right. Keep running. And Nola's not dead. She's alive. She's on the run. She saw something she shouldn't see, and now she's out there. She's the escape artist. And that's chapter one of the book. But it was going to Dover and going to see those things and going, you know, all the other stuff we had with the 9/11 flag and things I saw while researching that, that let me pound the keys so well.
Is this the place that was the former Army Medical Museum?
Let's talk about that. I can hear the music. Let's talk about that next.
I'll ask about that later. Yeah, all right. We're talking to Brad Meltzer about so many things he does. He writes thrillers. The Escape Artist is one of them, one of the dozen. Nonfiction books, including a new series for kids or a recent series for kids called Ordinary People Change the World. I Am Harriet Tubman is the latest in that series. We'll come back and talk more with Brad and take phone calls and emails from you in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of JPR. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Brad Meltzer, who is quite the creative force, primarily as a writer, but also as a TV host on the History Channel. We're going to go call it the History Channel for this hour, where he's hosted shows like Lost History. But he's best known for his writing. He's got 10 different thriller novels out, including the recent The Escape Artist. And he's written for comic books as well, written some nonfiction works, and has augmented those with a recent series for younger children, ages 4 to 8, called Ordinary People Change the World. I Am Harriet Tubman, the latest installation in that series. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So, Brad, to the Ordinary People Change the World series, even before that, you did have a couple of nonfiction books for kids, which were essentially born with your own kids, weren't they?
That's exactly right. I was tired of my own kids looking at reality TV show stars and people who are famous for being famous and thinking that that's a hero. So I started with books called Heroes for My Son and Heroes for My Daughter when my kids were born, to give them better heroes. And then eventually, as I got a little older, I realized it wasn't enough. If I told my daughter that Amelia Earhart flew across the Atlantic Ocean, she's like, big deal, Dad. Everyone flies across the Atlantic today. You know, she was not impressed. But if I tell her, and this is true, that when Amelia Earhart was 7 years old, she built a homemade roller coaster in her backyard, that she took a wooden crate and put roller skating wheels on the bottom of it, that she shoved it to the roof of her tool shed, got on top, came careening down, you know, these two wooden slats, and she crashed and flew through the air. And that was the first moment Amelia Earhart actually flew. She was 7 years old. She later said she wanted that feeling of her stomach bottoming out from her. She wanted that feeling back again. And I tell my daughter that, and now Amelia Earhart isn't some black and white figure in a history book. Amelia Earhart is someone who is really, you know, just a wild character. And so that's what we started doing. We started with an illustrated children's book series for young kids. We started with I'm Amelia Earhart and I'm Abraham Lincoln. We did I Am Rosa Parks. My son loves sports, and I did I Am Jackie Robinson for him because I wanted to show him what a real sports hero does. Doesn't just make millions and score points, but they help others. And my daughter, I did I Am Lucille Ball because I wanted her to have a female entertainment hero who wasn't just famous for being thin and pretty, that Lucy stands for the idea it's not just okay to be different, it's spectacular to be different. And for my youngest, who is a creator and loves to color, we did I Am Jim Henson, who is the creator of the Muppets. And even did I Am Jane Goodall. My daughter loves dogs and animals, so we did, you know, the famous scientist who studies animals and chimpanzees, we did I Am Jane Goodall. And the amazing thing happened with this series is we love doing it, but as the election was taking place last year, we saw something interesting happen, is our books I Am George Washington and I Am Martin Luther King Jr. started taking off. In a way, we were confused, and we realized it wasn't a Democrat or Republican thing. It was that people on both sides, parents and grandparents, were looking at the TV and seeing politicians. What they really wanted to see were leaders. And we all know there's a big difference between a leader and a politician. And I love that people use these books to help their kids learn real values, because the values we teach in these books, you know, whether it's, you know, on the back of I Am Abraham Lincoln, it says, I will speak my mind and speak for others. And on the back of I Am Amelia Earhart, it says, I will know no bounds. And we need these lessons of generosity and compassion. We need them so much today. Our kids are starving for heroes. And the I Am series is our best way to actually help them get them.
And Harriet Tubman on the back says, follow me, I will lead the way to freedom. She says, follow me a lot through the book. I mean, is this a technique that got refined as you went further into the series?
Yeah, you know, people think it's a history series, and it's not. It's a value series. And what we realized is that's what kids were starving for. You know, Harriet Tubman was, when she was a little girl, taught by her father what the North Star was. And he said that, you know, you follow the North, you know, the lesson was you follow the North Star to lead your way to freedom. And that was meant literally. You were a slave back then. The North Star told you go north. That's where freedom is. And Harriet Tubman eventually decides she's going to escape. She decides with her brothers. It's her and her brothers are going to escape where they are on the farm. And it's her brothers who get scared and turn back. It's Harriet Tubman, the young girl, my daughter, you know, I'm sure loves to point out, is the one who is the brave one who escapes. And now she's free. She has what every person who is enslaved wants, freedom. She gets a job. She can go live her life, and that's it. But instead, she realizes, wait a minute, there are so many other people out there who need my help. And she goes back, uses the Underground Railroad, which is, you know, it's not a real railroad, didn't have real cars. But it did have stops, places where people could hide if you were a slave and you wanted to escape slavery. And it had what they were called conductors, which were people who told you where to hide and told you the secret code so you can hide behind bookcases and in attics and in basements. And Harriet Tubman goes back and back and back again. And what it says in the book at the end is it says, in your life, in all of our lives, we always face challenges. Every single one of us is going to face a hard challenge. But the question is, at those times, can you make the safe choice or the right choice? So would you put yourself at risk to help someone else? Would you stand up to someone mighty to help someone who's weak? To answer those questions, you have to follow your heart, your own North Star. It will always point you in the right direction. And that is, you know, kids have a hard time maybe with slavery, but they understand what it is like to help someone else and to be a leader. And that's why Harriet Tubman through the book is keep saying, follow me, follow me. We really want to hit home that leadership quality.
Yeah, it really does ring through. By the time you get to the end of the book, you realize, wow, she's been saying follow me all along. I'm just getting it now. So maybe I'm slower than an eighth grader or an eight-year-old.
We all are.
That's true. Brad Meltzer is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the author of many books, including the series Ordinary People Change the World. The latest edition is called I Am Harriet Tubman. You know, it was interesting how there's a real craft here. I mean, we're dealing with things like people who get hit in the head by heavy weights when they're 11 years old and are kind of out of it for a while, which did really happen to Harriet Tubman. You've got the details about her working by age six and the mean people who told her to do things because they owned her. So this is a real craft, though, conveying the reality of a harsh life and yet not making it too much for younger readers to handle. I mean, did it take a lot of oscillation to find the right zone for this?
Yeah, no, listen, we tested it on our own kids. I mean, what else are we going to do, right? When I did I Am Abraham Lincoln was one of the first two books we did, and the publisher said, you really want to do slavery in a kid's book? I said, you better believe it. What's the point? Why are we, you know, if we take history and just turn it into the good things, no bad ever happened, we are serving our kids nothing in any way. You know, it's like there's some amazing thing that happens with kids, and the one thing I've learned being a dad now is that our kids are much stronger than we think. And, you know, if you can't show them good without showing them the bad. There is no good without there being bad. And if you just sanitize it to them, it's like giving everyone a participation trophy. Everything is good, everyone wins. You've taught them nothing. And we did I Am Abraham Lincoln. We showed them slavery. And we did it in a very, you know, small, subtle way so kids could understand it. And my son, to this day, sleeps with a little Abraham Lincoln doll that someone made from one of the books, because he just thinks Abraham Lincoln's so nice because he was so nice to those people. And I love that. And kids, you know, yes, you're right. You can't just go out there and give them the harshest, crassest reality of it, because it's just, you know, for some kids, it's obviously too much. But we work with people, you know, we work with one of the great Harriet Tubman biographers today on this book to make sure we're sensitive about it. When we did Dr. King's book, we worked with Representative John Lewis, read the book for us for sensitivity issues. When we did I Am Jane Goodall, Jane Goodall read the book herself for us. And when we did I Am Jim Henson, we had Jim Henson's daughters read the book for us. So each one of the books we really work with, kind of we try to find the expert in that field to make sure that we're being sensitive to all the issues and that we're bringing this to these kids. And the one thing that the kids can really grasp is we always start the book when the hero is a child. So like you said, Harriet Tubman, you see her as a little girl, and she says she was hit in the head with this very heavy weight. And after that, she had these dreams, and these dreams where she was flying. And there was she would fly over this big grassy patch, but she would always be stopped by this kind of this fence, this wall that she could never get past. And it doesn't take Freudian psychologist to realize what that wall is, that thing she couldn't get past and what it represented. But every kid knows what it's like to dream. Every kid knows what it's like to have hope and to have dreams out there. And when you do give that to kids, Harriet Tubman becomes just like them. And then these aren't the stories of famous people. This is what we're all capable of on our very best days. And that's what the I Am series and I Am Harriet Tubman really stands for.
And in fact, Harriet Tubman looks the same at the end of the book as she does at the beginning. So this is sort of like the child spirit inside still maintaining through life, through a very long life.
Yeah, no, and thank you for pointing that out. You know, one of the things, our secret weapon in these books is our artist, Chris Eliopoulos. And Chris, you know, I want my kids off their phones. I want them to be off their computers. But the only way to make that happen is you got to give them something better to look at. And what Chris does as an artist, as a cartoonist, is he has an art style that's a little bit like a cross between Charlie Brown and Calvin and Hobbes. And as a result, the kids are adorable. When we draw Abraham Lincoln, we draw him as a 7-year-old. We draw Harriet Tubman as a little 8-year-old. You know, we show them little. And we keep them little throughout the whole book. And it's a very conscious choice. When we first started the series, we actually made them big toward the end, and you saw them age. But the kids were bored. Then it became just another history book. They didn't care. When we keep them little, it's a subtle message. It's a subliminal message, but it's one that is so vital. We remind them, these people, these heroes were just like you once. And I think it's a lesson for not only our kids, but for all of us. Every person you admire, everyone you look up to as a hero, anyone you've ever thought, that's my hero, that person, all those people, they were scared and they were terrified and they thought they couldn't do it. And then they eventually succeeded in doing it and didn't stop. And for me, that's what we need to remind ourselves is every, you know, what we do too often today is we take our heroes and we make statues and we put them on dollar bills and they become these kind of calcified concrete things. They were people. They were all just like us. They were all flawed. They were all bold. They were all daring. All of us every day are terrified and amazing. We are all of us brave and cowards, and we are all of us incredible. Sometimes all in the same hour, sometimes all in a couple minutes, but that's how life is.
Truly, all of us brave and cowards. I'm writing that down right now. Brad Meltzer is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His series of books for children is called Ordinary People Change the World. The latest is I Am Harriet Tubman. This is in addition to Brad's many political thrillers and his other nonfiction work and his TV work. He's done a lot. You can join us here on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. You mentioned Calvin and Hobbes, and actually, when I first saw Christopher Eliopoulos' work, I thought I was looking at Bill Watterson's work. It's good, but it's interesting that the passage he had to come through to get to this point, because I guess he was lettering comics originally?
Yeah, Chris started, he was a cartoonist, but he started lettering, did Spider-Man, did the X-Men, did every comic, you know, you've read from Marvel in the past 20 years. But he would do cartoons for them, so he would do young versions of Spider-Man and Fantastic Four, and I came upon his work, and I was, you know, it's very easy for a cartoonist to do cute. Everyone can even do funny if you're really good, but what is much harder is to do heart. And I knew that when we were doing this series, if I wanted kids to fall in love with Abraham Lincoln or Harriet Tubman or Rosa Parks or whoever it might be, Amelia Earhart, that they had to have heart. They had to show, like, the amazing people that these people were. And Chris is a huge history nerd like myself, and he came on board and just, as you can see in the book, is just raised his game. And as I said, he's our secret weapon. He's why kids react to these books. It's not that I'm a great writer. It's that we have the best stories in all of history, the most inspiring stories in all of history, in Abraham Lincoln and, you know, in Jackie Robinson and Albert Einstein. And then we have Chris illustrating them in a way that kids find completely lovable. And what I think is the best part of it for me is it's never been about one book, you know, Jackie Robinson or Lincoln or anyone else. But I love that parents and grandparents out there are using our books to build libraries of real heroes for their kids and their grandkids and their nieces and nephews.
I can imagine some surprises in the research. I mean, I didn't realize the extent to which Harriet Tubman got involved in the war effort for the North.
Yeah, no, what you just pointed out, my favorite detail that when I came upon it, I was like, I did not know that.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, during this, you know, we all think of Harriet Tubman and, you know, she went back and freed so many people from slavery, from being enslaved. But when the Civil War is obviously going on, she becomes the first American woman to lead an armed raid into enemy territory. And Secretary of War Stanton for Abraham Lincoln is like, wait, Harriet Tubman's spying, they're incredible. She's like, she proved that black people could serve in the military just as well as white people could. And as a woman at that time during the Civil War, and then when she leaves the Civil War, when the Civil War is over, she continues to fight. She has no money. She has nothing left, but she still keeps opening her home to elderly African Americans out there who need a place to stay, people who need to be fed, and she just can't help it. She just keeps being that leader. It's a God bless her. And I need my kids to see that too. You know, it says in the book that in life, you know, we're all kind of like birds. And some days we fly high and some days we fly low. But every one of us, and we all know, again, adults or kids, we all know this is true. When you pass the clouds and you reach the top, you have a choice. You can stay up there and enjoy the view, or you can come back down and bring others up to join you. And look at the world today. Look at where we are as a culture. We hate each other. We're fighting. We're playing this game, us versus them, and they're wrong and we're right. We hate anyone with a view opposite ours. But what I use Harriet Tubman for is to remind my kids that we are our strongest when we're helping each other. And we've lost that right now as a culture, and we need to get back to that. We need to remind our kids that we're strongest when we work together. Because if not, we're in real trouble. And I love that I Am Harriet Tubman can bring that lesson.
Yeah, Harriet Tubman is just the latest in the series, Ordinary People Change the World, by Brad Meltzer with artist Christopher Eliopoulos. How often do these come out? I wanted more when I was done with Harriet Tubman.
That's our 14th book. They come out basically almost every 4 months. We do three a year. So this past year, in the last calendar year, we did Harriet Tubman, we did Gandhi, we did Sacagawea. The year before that, we did, I love the fact that we did Dr. King, Jane Goodall, and George Washington. And the next one that's coming out in September is we're doing I Am Neil Armstrong.
Oh, yeah.
And it's really fun for us because Chris Eliopoulos, our artist, has been begging to do Neil Armstrong since the very first books. He didn't want to do Abraham Lincoln. He wanted to do Neil Armstrong from the very start. And so we really got really nerdy. Chris drew, put his life into it. Every rivet on every rocket, every single detail is on there. And we sent it to a buddy who used to work at NASA because we always want to proof it with the best people in the industry. And the book came back and we said, what'd you think? And he's like, you guys are such nerds. Like he just, you know, and we were. We just wanted to get it. So when the former NASA guy is calling you a nerd, you know you're doing something right.
Truly.
But I Am Neil Armstrong is just a great lesson in, you know, taking the first step and hard work. And most important, something lost today in society is humility. He was never about himself. Neil Armstrong always talked in that we, that everything they did was about we. And I think our kids need to remember what humility is. So I Am Neil Armstrong comes out in September.
Brad, are these harder than the novels because, A, you're dealing with real people, and, B, you're trying to find a good tone to hit that will impress upon, you know, 4 to 8 year olds how important these people were and yet not bore them?
Yeah, you know, I mean, listen, I love that people buy them as baby books and give them out when kids are born, or buy them, you know, for 10-year-olds or whoever, you know, like and it's hard to know, you know, in between each kid is different. But I think that the reason when it's nonfiction, it's harder and it's easier. And it's easier because I don't got to make anything up, right? It happened or it didn't happen. That's it. There's no imagination, right? The story happened like this and this is how it happened. Stick to the facts. And it's amazing how many, even adult books, have so much myth in them. And we really work hard to try and make sure all of our facts are right. You know, we don't. When George Washington's crossing the Delaware, he's not at the front of the boat standing up like every picture. Any historian will tell you that that's fake. That's not how it happened. So Chris actually went and researched the real boats that it's in, you know, approximated what it really looked like, and tried to bring a little reality back. Because if we just make myths, we're not, you know, we're losing our history. And one of the things that I love about it is that I don't have to make it up. But the hardest part of that is, sometimes the story isn't the way you want it to go, and I can't change it, right? Like with fiction, if I don't like the way it happened, that's okay. I'll make a new way. I'll make it even better. And so, again, some parts easier, some parts harder. With fiction, the great part is I get to make it up. I get to go out there and, you know, change it to whatever I want it to be to make it dramatic. But the hard part is, man, I got to find the imagination to make it up. And you got to stare at a blank page, and sometimes a blank page is just a blank page, and you got nothing. So no one way is easier. Each brings its own challenges.
How many laptops have you worn out now?
I'm about to actually, you know me too well, I'm about to wear out this one that I'm on right now.
Brad Meltzer is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, talking about I Am Harriet Tubman and the rest of the Ordinary People Change the World series. We have many more questions about his other projects as well, and we'll get to those on the other side of a break. This is the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio, back in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking with Brad Meltzer about Harriet Tubman. He wrote a book for children 4 to 8 years old, I Am Harriet Tubman. She says, follow me. I will lead the way to freedom. She says, follow me a lot in the book, which is one of the effective things about it, both for kids and for adults reading it as well. It is just the latest in a series called Ordinary People Change the World. And it is looks like about a dozen titles long right now, which keeps up with the fact that Brad Meltzer's also written 12 political thrillers and a couple of nonfiction books and some comic books, and he hosts TV shows on the History Channel. He's just a busy guy. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So when you write child biographies of the likes of Abraham Lincoln and George Washington, and you write political thrillers as well, you mentioned how carefully you do your research. And I want to come back to this former Army Medical Museum where you held the bones of the assassinated President Garfield.
Yeah. So, I thought you were actually talking about a different museum but let's talk about that one, because I have one even more interesting in the new book. Yeah. When I was researching The Fifth Assassin, one of my thrillers, there's this medical museum that they actually just moved out of D.C. and up to Maryland, where they actually have the bones of Garfield and also John Wilkes Booth there. I held the spine of John Wilkes Booth in my hand, you know, of course, famously killed Abraham Lincoln. And I'm holding this in my hand going, what has my life come to? You know, my wife is like, when did your life become Forrest Gump, you know, where you're holding former president's bones? But it really is an incredible, you know, Washington, D.C. is filled with incredible places. In fact, for the new thriller, the one that comes out next week, I was researching The Escape Artist. We were doing the very first episode of Lost History, and we were looking for the 9/11 flag. And because we were looking for the flag, they wanted it to be in kind of a military background place. So they brought us to a military museum that's out in Virginia on an Army base. And on this base, we're in the museum, and I see they have all this art on the walls. They have art by generals, but they also have art in their collection by Adolf Hitler. And I'm looking around and I'm going, why does the U.S. government have all this art? It made no sense to me. And then they told me, well, you got to come meet the artist in residence, which I'd never heard of. I didn't know what it was. It was one of the most obscure jobs in the U.S. government. And they explained to me that since World War I, the U.S. Army has had an actual painter, someone who paints on staff, who rushes into disasters to document them. So whether it's the beaches of Normandy or whether it's Vietnam or whether it's 9/11, we've had a painter run in. So everyone else is running in with guns and armed to the teeth, and this painter is running in armed with nothing more than paintbrushes in their pockets. And I thought, that's the craziest person I've ever heard of. I want to meet him. And then they said to me, you mean you want to meet her? And I said, what? She's a woman? And I almost fell over because I was so excited. I was like, this is going to be the greatest new character. And sure enough, she was what helped me give birth to this character, Nola, that is really the star of The Escape Artist. And it's this amazing woman. The Escape Artist is not just for Harry Houdini artist, but it's an artist who paints too. And now I see the artist part of that, deals with.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Wow, that's some great research you get to do, isn't it?
Yeah, and you know what? That's the fun. Like, I love reading a good thriller. I love turning the pages on a good mystery. But in a book like The Escape Artist, I love, when I'm a reader, when I get to learn something. And so for The Escape Artist, like here, I'll read page one to you. It says, in 1898, a man named John Elbert Wilkie was put in charge of the Secret Service. And he was a friend of Harry Houdini. He also was a magician himself. He loved to do magic tricks. It is the only time in history that a magician was in charge of the Secret Service. And I had that detail, and I sat on that detail for, you know, the better part of a decade. And I just was like, I got to do something with that. I got to use that somewhere. And The Escape Artist was born out of, even though it's a fictional thriller, but it's built on these real facts from history.
So let's talk about some of the other writing, though, outside of these, because you've written, I don't know, like a year's worth of Justice League of America, for example, for DC, and a bunch of Green Arrows, and even some Buffy the Vampire Slayer for Dark Horse. How different is that kind of writing from the other stuff?
You know, again, a good story is a good story. So when I'm doing May, we're going to do a Superman story that is going to be coming out for Action Comics number 1000. It's their big anniversary.
Oh, 80 years. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so I'm very excited to be a part of that. And if I do a Superman story, a good story is a good story, but here's the difference. When I write a novel like The Escape Artist, I'm painting with one palette and one palette only. It's the palette of words. I have infinite permutations. You know, I can say someone's nervous. I can say that they're tapping their foot, they're biting their nails, they're sweating. I can say whatever I want. I can use that, any permutation of words, you know, but I got to use that palette. When you're writing a comic book like Superman, you got to learn how to shut up because you have a different palette to work with. It's not just words. And this is the kids' books too, but it's art. You have an artist there who's going to draw it. And so I can tell, you know, I write exactly what it says. Panel one, I want to be close up from Superman from the waist up. We see the big red S. We see the spit curl. I want to see him from the waist up. Panel two, pulling a little closer on his face. Panel three, pulling even closer so that we're closer to the spit curl. Panel four, I want to see a little bead of sweat coming down just by the brow near the spit curl. Panel five, pulling closer even on that little bead of sweat. Panel six, we're so close on the bead of sweat we can see in the reflection of it who Superman is talking to. And I haven't used a single word. I don't have to say a single word. That page could be silent, and you know Superman is sweating something. He is nervous about something. And if you're a real nerd, you know the Kryptonians don't sweat.
Right.
But I will say that's the fun, right? The fun of it is that you get to use the artist to tell your story as well. And that, of course, becomes incredibly freeing, especially when you have amazing artists like the ones I've been lucky enough to work with.
But, Brad, can comic audiences be really hard to please, particularly when you wiggle with the backstory a little bit?
Of course. No, listen, you're talking about characters that have been around for 80 years. And there's this kind of ownership that happens. I truthfully, it's a good thing and it's a bad thing. Like just about everything in life, your greatest strength is your greatest weakness. And the great strength of comics is that it has this amazing fan base that just lives for it and dies for it and will support you at every level. And the very, you know, the greatest weakness of the comic book audience is that it gets so married to things, it just wants to preserve its childhood sometimes. And that is, you know, if you look at the new Star Wars movie, that's what the allegory was, right? That's what Yoda's talking about, is like you can't be so precious with it. Sometimes you got to just burn it down and start over. And I'm actually not of the faith that you got to burn everything down, or, you know, that there's one, it's a binary one choice. But I do think if you are too precious with it, you're not going to get good story. You will get your childhood back, but you're not going to move anywhere. There will be no progress without making some changes. And I think you just, you know, you have to kind of figure out what's good, and you got to trust your gut on that.
So aside from what you do with the stories, though, your dedication to do some of this, and it's preserving childhoods for a lot of people, is legendary. You played a role, I understand, in saving Superman's birthplace in Cleveland?
Yeah, that was one of those ones that was a once-in-a-lifetime. I went, I was researching this book that I wrote called The Book of Lies. And the book was about the murder weapon that Kane used to kill Abel. And I also wanted to deal with Jerry Siegel, who's the writer who created Superman. That you had here, I had, you know, these great characters, you know, the greatest evil, the first villain ever created in Kane, and the greatest American superhero ever created in Superman. And I was researching the creation of Superman. I wanted to say historically where he came from. He was born in Cleveland, Ohio. The writers and the artist who worked on him and created him, with Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, came from Cleveland. And I went to the house where Superman was created. I'm in the middle of this really kind of, it's a, you know, I figured it would be something out of a Norman Rockwell painting. And I get down the block, and it's a rough block. It's one of those blocks where spray painted on the outsides of houses, it says, you know, no copper pipes inside, PVC only, because people are breaking in and stealing pipes.
Mm.
So you know you're in a tough neighborhood. And I got to the house where Superman was created. It was wrecked. There were holes in the walls, holes in the ceilings. It was devastated. And I just said, you know what, we got to do something about this. So I contacted all my friends in comics, friends like Jim Lee and friends like Joe Quesada, and we started an auction. Our goal was to raise $50,000 to repair the house where Superman was created. And we were lucky enough, we raised over $100,000 in a week, or in 2 weeks, I think it was, and we repaired the house. It is now, if you go there, put in Superman House Cleveland. Next time you go to Cleveland, take a 10-minute visit out of town and go see this place that is now a part of history. You can go even see it online. It's beautiful. There's a big red S out in front right now. And my favorite moment is this, is we were sitting outside of the house, and this young, you know, I'm a white, pale guy. And as we're sitting outside the house, right when it first happened, we were doing some videoing of the house, this young African-American kid who in any other version you would say is right out of central casting of a gang. And, you know, one of those kids who you're just, okay, what situation am I in right now? And he stops on his bike, and he looks at us with these tough, hardened eyes, and I'm like thinking to myself, what's going to happen here? And he says, hey, is that really the house where Superman was created? And I said, yeah. And he starts rolling up his T-shirt to reveal on his arm. And I'm like, what's he doing? And he pulls up his T-shirt, and on his arm is a Superman tattoo. And right there, he smiled, and we were friends. And, you know, I love that white, black, whatever you are, however old you are, young or old, we all know the value of Superman. You know, and the best part of the story is not Superman. The best part of the story is Clark Kent, because we're all Clark Kent. We all know what it's like to be boring and ordinary and wish we could do something incredibly beyond ourselves.
Truly that. I always get stuck by the fact that Jerry and Joe sold the rights to Superman for, what, $500?
No, $130.
$130. Oh, man. But ultimately, DC made good with the family, I understand. And I mean,
they made a bad deal for many years, and it took a lot of legal wrangling, and they're still working their things out. But, you know, listen, you got to take care of the creators. You got to take care of the creators of this stuff, because a lot of these guys, you know, there's a place called Comics Alliance that takes care of the old comic book creators, a charity we love and, of course, support. Because a lot of these guys, they create, you know, these heroes, whether it's, you know, Wolverine or Batman or any others. And, you know, back then, no one knew what the value of them was. So they, you know, they would write these characters when they were 20 years old, and then they would get old. Characters would continue, make movies, make, you know, have this great success, and then they'd be poor. I mean, Joe Shuster, who was the artist on Superman, was blind at the end of his life.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there's an artist who couldn't see. You got to take care of the creators.
And you take care of literacy, too. I notice your commitment to it with a focus on Florida where you live. But man, you just have fun with the stuff you do. I was looking at your Storytime sessions on YouTube, including the one with Barbara Bush and you dressed up as Lucille Ball. How did that come about?
Yeah, so we did I Am Lucille Ball in our kids' book series. And Barbara Bush, former First Lady Barbara Bush, is a Lucy fan, and we were going to do a story time together, and we've done story times that people can show their kids and their grandkids on YouTube, but I said, I want to recreate the Lucy chocolate conveyor belt scene, and she was like, you're serious, and I was like, yep, let's do it, and so I dressed up like Lucy in drag, and it was actually the video you see there, when you put my name in Barbara Bush in YouTube, and it comes up, it's actually in the president's office, and I had to eat like 5,000 chocolates in 2 minutes. Because I'm shoving all these chocolates in my mouth, and it was one of the most surreal. When I look back at it, we did it all in one take. We didn't practice, we didn't do it, we just did it. And it's one of the funniest things. And you can, if you listen really carefully, you can hear the staff in the background laughing because they said that they've never seen Barbara Bush, you know, former First Lady of the United States. It was so funny and it was so absurd, and we just had such a good time with it. And again, just one of those things you just can't even realize how it happens.
Can you even look at a Hershey's Kiss anymore?
I can, but every time, the thing that was really funny is when I was done and I had a new appreciation for Lucille Ball, is I had such a sugar rush. She's like, what are we doing now? I'm like, I don't know, ma'am, where do you want to go? You know, because I was so hyped up on that sugar rush. When you eat 1,000 of them so quickly, it comes so, I was like, let's go lift cars up. but new appreciation because I'm sure they must have filmed it 50 different times in 50 different ways for Lucille Ball.
Wow, that was amazing stuff. Before we go, I do want to ask briefly, and we promise not to tell anyone, about your work for Homeland Security.
Yeah, this that was a crazy one. So a few years ago, many years ago now, I got a call from the Department of Homeland Security asking me to come in and brainstorm different ways that terrorists could attack the United States. And my first thought was, if they're calling me, we have bigger problems than anybody thinks, right? But I was struck by that, and they would pair me with a Secret Service agent and a chemist. They would give us a target city, Seattle, Los Angeles, pick, you know, wherever you want, and they would tell us to destroy it. And the Secret Service agent would come up with his way through security, and then I would come up with my way that I, you know, that gets us in. And the chemist would say, no, you know, let's use this chemical. It'll dissipate less quickly in the air. And we would destroy a major city in an hour. And it's not one of those days you go home feeling good. You go home terrified because you see how easy it is to kill us. But one of the things I was struck with is, why me? Why'd they pick me? And I traced it back through history. It traced back to a man named George Washington. That George Washington had his own secret spy ring during the Revolutionary War called the Culper Ring. And it was made up of regular, ordinary citizens. And why? Because Washington knew he had the top military people, but he knew everyone knew who they were, but no one looks twice at an ordinary person. And I said to my friend in Homeland Security, wouldn't it be cool if you found out that George Washington's spy ring still existed to this very day? And he said to me, what makes you think it doesn't? And I was like, that's a good idea for a book. So I wrote The Inner Circle, which was a book based on that, and The Fifth Assassin and The President's Shadow, and now here we are with The Escape Artist, the one after.
Wow. So much to talk about, as always, with Brad Meltzer. So many titles out, a dozen titles now in the Thriller series, and a dozen coming with the Neil Armstrong one and the Ordinary People Change the World book. The latest in my hand is I Am Harriet Tubman. Brad Meltzer, thanks so much for joining us today on The Exchange.